Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and you are listening to the podcast about all things undisclosed. Here at the Addendum, we get a chance to hash out the latest episode of Undisclosed. We answer listener questions, and we also get the opinions of some of our most interesting fans. So in episode 9 of Undisclosed, Free, the UD3 examined the case against Mark Free, the supposed trigger man in the murder of Isaac Dawkins, and his tenuous ties to Joey Watkins. And with us today are two of the hosts of Undisclosed. We have Colin Miller, who's an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blogs. Say hello, Colin.
Hey, John. How's it going?
And we also have Rabia Chaudhry, and she would rather I not read her bio because she's sick of hearing all the bios, but I'm going to read it for one reason and one reason alone, because not only is she an attorney and a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and not only does she blog at splitthemoon.com, but she is now a New York Times best-selling author. So, ladies and gentlemen, Rabia Chaudhry.
Thanks so much for that intro, John. It sounds so good to hear it again and again and again and again.
Now that you are a big New York Times fancy best-selling author type person, have you decided that you're going to have some sort of authorly affectation? You know, like how Tom Wolfe has the white suits and stuff?
I think I should adopt an accent. I'm just trying to figure out which one right now. I don't look good in white. That's not going to work for me. But I think an accent would be appropriate. You know, the New York Times bestselling list is amazing. And I'm so happy that we were able to get on it. And, you know, I think Adnan might be one of the first people incarcerated to make that. Well, maybe not. I don't know. But anyway, I figure the next time it should be something more along, so like 50 Shades of Grey. We'll see. A lighter read.
Okay. Well, I'm going to make a suggestion here and hear me out. I'm thinking a monocle. Nobody else is doing it. Yes, you can be like the Flavor Flav of the New York Times bestselling author set.
I guess if there's one way to make myself look less attractive, that would be it. But I will consider it. Thank you.
Well, thank you for considering it. But now this brings us to our special guest of the week. And for those of you who listen to True Crime Podcast, you're probably already familiar with his voice. He is Jim Clemente, and he's a retired FBI supervisory special agent, as well as a profiler and a former New York City prosecutor. During his 22-year career with the FBI, he's investigated cases from bank robberies to serial killers, as well as a public corruption in the White House. He's a technical advisor, writer, and producer for Criminal Minds, Quantico, Blind Spot, and Secrets and Lies. He appears regularly as host and a guest on the YouTube channel Crime Time. But of course, I'm a huge fan of his from his podcast, Real Crime Profile, which he does with Laura Richards and Lisa Zambetti. But I got to say, I'm really looking forward to your two-part investigation special that's going to be on CBS, The Case of JonBenet Ramsey. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you very much, John and Rabia and Colin. I'm really excited about doing this. I mean, you guys have done some amazing work, and you should all be applauded as heroes.
Thanks for coming on, Jim.
Well, I wanted to ask you just about the JonBenet case for a moment. So in looking at the Ramsey case, it's been 20 years. I think you had just started at the FBI when that actually occurred.
Actually, I had just started at the Behavioral Analysis Unit. I'd already been in the FBI about 10 years when it occurred.
Ah, so now looking at the case 20 years on, was there any information about that? I mean, you weren't involved in that case at the time. Am I correct?
As a matter of fact, I wasn't right in the beginning, but because it was initially a kidnapping, it's an FBI matter. So everybody in the FBI was notified about it. And because at the time I was an expert and building my expertise in child sex crimes, that was also an issue that I was very much involved in. It wasn't until about a year later when I was promoted into the Behavioral Analysis Unit as a profiler that I actually worked it as a consultant, as we do from the BAU. We consult on all violent and sexual crimes across the country.
So after 20 years, was there any information that still surprised you or gave you a new take on the case?
You know, John, it was pretty amazing. Yes, we applied new technologies to old evidence and found some new evidence as a result. We also talked to people who had never spoken publicly before about what they knew. So our show is an active investigation. We actually just documented an actual investigation. I pulled together a bunch of my colleagues that I had worked together with on the case over the course of the last 20 years, and we did a reinvestigation. Dr. Henry Lee, Dr. Werner Spitz, Jim Fitzgerald, James Kohler, Stan Burke and Laura Richards and I put this team together, and she was from Scotland Yard, and she had done one of the cold case evaluations of the JonBenet Ramsey case with us years ago. Each one of us has a particular area of expertise, and that's the beauty of what we did in the behavioral analysis unit. People tear it apart from their different perspectives, and you really drill down and argue about things, and what comes out at the end is pure genius.
So, Jim, you know, one of my questions that I listened to you, you know, how you go back and you've looked at some of the evidence, again, applied new technologies, is I'm just kind of curious because, like, for example, in Adnan's case, private investigators and private individuals can't really access, if there is physical evidence somewhere in a locker somewhere, like, we can't access it. It has to go through some kind of legal proceeding, like his attorney. If there's a proceeding that it makes sense to, you know, subpoena the stuff through, then they'd have to do it, or the state themselves could do it. But were you guys able to access that kind of evidence yourself, or is it just what was existing already?
Yeah, the scientific evidence, no. But what we did was we actually reconstructed the entire relevant floors of the house in a 70,000 square foot warehouse so that we could actually do a crime scene reconstruction there and look at the ingress and egress and the movement of people, where they were at particular times. And we could actually test many of the theories that were out there. Also, we were able to actually develop a comprehensive theory based on everything that's out there, as opposed to just sort of picking and choosing things like a number of the different sides of this issue have always done. Because James Kohler is currently a law enforcement officer, we did have access to some of the documentary evidence that may not have been sort of available to the general public.
Yeah, Jim, I wanted to ask, it's interesting because Adnan's case very much comes down to these 21 minutes after school and being a very short window of time to commit the crime. And I know that a big part of your investigation, from what I've seen in preparation for this show, is this ransom note that was found at the Ramsey house. And 21 minutes comes into play with that too, right?
Yes, it's actually eerie, I think. So we did a test demonstration of how long it would take to actually just copy the ransom note in the exact form that it was. And it took us 21 minutes and 28 seconds, I believe. And doing that, though, we went back and realized that a number of the I's, and there were like 100 I's in this letter, that the letter itself, the original letter, had every single I dotted and T crossed. And we had missed a bunch of them. So whoever did this meticulously wrote that letter, taking their time, making sure everything was perfect, and even did a practice note. So there are a number of things that brings out in our show, and we'll discuss them in great detail.
Can I ask, how did the show come about? Were you approached by producers? Was this your idea to assemble this team?
Yeah, absolutely. I was very frustrated over the course of my career at not having this case being resolved. Jim Fitzgerald, I worked with him in the behavioral analysis unit. I worked together with him my entire FBI career. Right before we retired, we made a pact that we were either going to write a book or do something to get the information out. Since I became a producer out here and I saw that you could reach millions of people instantly, we decided that was the best way to go. So we put together this team and the show, and we partnered with Critical Content, who's a great production company, who, by the way, has a tremendous amount of experience building houses in a really short period of time on extreme home makeovers. So we partnered with them. We rebuilt the house. We sold the show to CBS. They've been great partners with us, and they're going to put it out to the world so they'll see what the truth is.
And when is that on the air?
It'll be Sunday, September 18th at 8:30 to 10:30, and then Monday, September 19th. At 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock.
Well, I am very much looking forward to seeing that. But I want to take a moment right now, actually. We will get into the Joey Watkins case. But I do want to take a moment now to thank our sponsors and to send you over to them for this little message.
Blue Apron supports a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the U.S. Today, I want to focus on the fisheries. Blue Apron has partnered with fisheries to source only sustainable seafood, and as a result, all their fish and shellfish are rated best choice or good alternative by the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch, with whom they partner closely to develop their standards. So if you love good sustainable fish or simply good sustainable food, check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/up. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/up.
So, Jim, it seems that your skill as a profiler is one of the most interesting aspects of your background. Looking at the crime, we have basically a man driving a truck who's shot and then veers off the road. Looking at it as a profiler, How would you see that same set of evidence?
Well, this is an interesting case because it's a unique type of case. In other words, there are many cases across the country where people get shot while they're driving. There are certainly cases where people shoot from a car in a drive-by random shooting or intentional murder. But to have both of them happen at the same time is quite rare. It's not something that happens every day. The logistics of it are very complicated. And I think even one of the defendants had said that it probably took a lot of skill and a lot of luck. And I agree with that completely. It's a very difficult crime to pull off as a sort of premeditated homicide. There would have been many other, much easier ways to commit that crime if that were the actual intent.
Yeah, you've often spoken of how you go into the victimology in this particular situation. It seems like that's, in many respects, what the Rome PD did was they investigated, you know, Isaac's life and who might have a grudge against him. Would that be a big component of what you were doing?
Sure. When you start with victimology, it's sort of like holding up a mirror to the offender, because the offender typically picks a particular victim at a particular time, in a particular place, in a particular manner, for a particular purpose. And all those choices reflect back on the offender and what their skills, abilities, motives are. So those are the kinds of things that can lead to, by looking at who was killed and how they lived, it will typically lead you back, you reverse engineer back to the who killed them. So those questions are critically important. However, you have to actually keep an open mind. You don't just go and say, well, somebody has a grudge, so they killed them. You have to actually then drill down and find the evidence to corroborate or refute that.
So I also find it interesting that you've been on also a prosecutor. And in this last episode of Undisclosed, it was revealed that they relied extensively on jailhouse informants during the trial of both Mark Free and Joey Watkins. As a prosecutor, was that something that you found yourself involved in a lot?
Well, I think minimally as a prosecutor, we have definitely used jailhouse informants over the course of my FBI career. But in the FBI, we use informants mainly as intelligence bases. To use an informant as the only connecting witness in a trial, I think is an extremely dangerous and weak thing to do, generally based on the entire prison culture. There's a lot of things you really have to take into account. If you don't understand, you know, the amount of lying and false bravado and even false bragging that goes on in prison, because you're literally locked in with a bunch of really dangerous people, people sometimes try to pump up their hype so that they don't feel vulnerable in prison. You have to really be sensitive to that fact when you talk to jailhouse informants.
This is something that I've been thinking about a lot in terms of the way evidence is presented and used to secure a conviction against somebody. I mean, to me, the way you framed it, Jim, makes total sense. Like, using jailhouse snitches as like really your primary evidence is just kind of unconscionable. But I also wonder, with Colin, I mean, like, do you know if there's any differences, whether like on the federal level or even state by state on this? I mean, are there any states in which you're just not allowed to use jailhouse snitches in this way? To me, it just seems so obviously so flawed and so fraught with risk to do that. I just don't understand even why it's even permissible or admissible.
Yeah, there's no state that outright bans it, but certain states have taken efforts to ensure that there is reliability and corroboration. So California, for instance, in 2011, they passed a law that said there has to be corroboration to allow for the admission of jailhouse informant testimony. In Illinois, where I used to live, they actually have a law there where there's a hearing. If you want to present informant testimony at trial, there's a hearing pre-trial where the judge assesses the reliability, and if the judge finds they're not reliable enough, the prosecutor is precluded from presenting that informant. And so actually, that's something that's a big push that states are making. I know in Virginia recently, there was a case where this was something that came up. So that is the more the trend is to ensure reliability as opposed to have an outright ban.
What kind of corroboration would work, though? I mean, let's say you have like three jailhouse snitches. I mean, in this case, with Mark Free, there were like, I think almost 20 or I don't know how many dozens of them that eventually popped up over time. Would they be considered corroborating each other?
Yeah, there's no hard and fast rule. It's very fact-censored the way the judge does it. But if you have multiple jailhouse informants, does their testimony match up? Are the extrinsic factors about when it took place making it more or less reliable? So in the Joey Watkins case, where you can have basically this timeline where no one's saying anything, the reward posters are put up, and then right after that you have a number of informants coming forward, that would certainly be something in Illinois, for instance, where the judge would look at that and say, this is pretty lacking in reliability and likely exclude that testimony.
The California law is basically, it kind of mirrors what our practice was in federal court, because we went beyond, I think, any of the actual statutes in terms of making sure that there was actual corroboration. Just like Colin said, I mean, if you have multiple informants, that can be considered corroboration, but they could all be motivated for the same exact reason. And they could all be based on, like I was saying earlier, just the prison culture of this false bravado. When people go into prison, if they go into prison for rape, they can be really taken advantage of. They could be brutalized in prison or for child sex crimes. So a lot of people will come up with other stories about what they did. And particularly in situations where they feel like they are being threatened, they may overstate what they've done and how tough they are, because they're living in a culture that only respects that and nothing else. So it's something you really have to take into account. But I really believe that there should be additional either physical evidence or scientific evidence or documentary evidence that confirms this jailhouse confession. And many times what we would do in the FBI is make sure that those kinds of confessions were only admitted if they were actually recorded in some fashion. And so we would take measures to do that in an effort to make sure that the person who's coming in to testify isn't just making it up.
Well, also, my understanding is that when people are incarcerated, you know, obviously prosecutors would have to divulge if they've made some formal deal with somebody who's turning state's evidence. But my understanding is there's so many ways that you can incentivize informants that aren't formal, that it's almost impossible to be certain that even if they're making assurances in court that they haven't been given any special consideration for their testimony, that they can be compensated in some other way.
Yeah, absolutely. Because just living in prison, there are so many ways that prisoners can be either set upon by the people that are holding them there or actually put in a position of comfort. And those are very important details to somebody who's planning on staying in prison for quite a while, even a short term, actually. But because of that, there are benefits that would never be on paper that could be bestowed upon somebody for cooperating. And I would particularly look very carefully at anybody who has done that multiple times. To have one person, you know, spontaneously confess to you while you're in prison, that's one thing. But to have multiple prisoners over a period of time, the chances of that actually being completely honest is probably very, very small.
Well, I have a question. You know, if you have somebody who becomes a jailhouse informant or snitch, I'm assuming word gets around inside the prison. I mean, doesn't that put that person also at risk with the other inmates?
Absolutely. And I think that they do it only if they can sort of derive a benefit from it. And it can also be, listen, there's a lot of culture that goes on in prison. It's not a fun place to be. They're constantly attacking each other in different ways. It's a very stressful situation to be in. And they can set somebody up by deciding that, okay, we're going to tell that this guy did something that he didn't do or confessed to something that he didn't do. And that can actually be used as a way of attacking somebody and really hurting somebody in the system. And so that would not be really seen as being a rat. It would be seen as effectively neutralizing somebody they wanted to get to. They didn't have to commit a crime to do it, you know, a physical crime to do it. All they had to do was open their mouth and tell the cops. So the system can be manipulated. It's a very complicated society inside a prison. And you have to be completely aware of that. And another point, just parallel to that, is that a prison society is very different than a jail society. The people that are in jail are pending trial, basically, or under really short sentences, under a year. So the chances of somebody who's actually in the midst of trial or waiting to be tried actually bragging to somebody else in there about what he did or didn't do, I think, is minimal. The people that have already been convicted of those crimes, well, they've already been convicted. So when they're in prison, I think they're more likely to talk to their cellmates about what they did or didn't do. So I think that's a whole nother level that we have to look at, where did this supposed disclosure happen?
Well, in listening to the last episode of Undisclosed, this brings up the testimony of Joey Samples, because the entire scenario that he described in terms of what Mark said to him when the reward poster went up was just all completely implausible to me. You know, when I actually went through the beats of it, when you go, wait a minute, this makes no sense. First, he sees the bulletin go up, and then he's upset and sad about it, so he needs a shoulder to cry on. But then he gets all cagey. Well, I don't know. Maybe I did it. Maybe I didn't. None of it makes any rational sense. But I think to a layman who doesn't know anything about being in jail or prison culture or anything like that, our impressions are from the movies. We don't have any accurate context to draw from.
Right. And I think this is a perfect example of where an education expert would be appropriate for a jury. Just like in the drug trade or in child sex crimes, we can put forth experts who actually educate the jury so that when they hear the evidence and see the evidence, it's done with an educated eye and ear. And you can then rely more on their interpretation of what goes on. But when you just sort of throw this information out to people who have no idea what's going on behind bars, I think it's irresponsible. I think Joey Samples, the contradictory statements that he makes on the motivation of this sort of voluntary self-incriminating statement, which I can't say ever amounted to a confession. It sounds very much like it was equivocal at best, and certainly doesn't, to me, it would match more some kind of boastful bragging than some kind of actual confession, because there were not specific details in that supposed confession, and he didn't actually say he did it. He might have been preventing himself from looking bad by saying, no, actually, I'm completely innocent, and I'm not a criminal at all, and I'm actually very vulnerable here. He wanted to at least leave the impression, perhaps, that, hey, I'm a tough guy. I could have done it, so watch out for me. And that happens.
But I think one of the things that bolstered Joey Samples on the stand was, my understanding was he was released pretty soon after that and wasn't in prison anymore. Is that correct, Colin?
Yeah, right. That's my recollection. Yeah, he was released soon thereafter. And so in terms of a benefit, right, it would be tough for the defense to argue that he got anything in the way of an overt benefit for his testimony.
But of course, he could have gotten it while he was still incarcerated, you know, if he came forward while he was still there. I don't know. Did he come forward while he was still in prison?
He did. Yeah. And so, I mean, you can certainly say, regardless of whether he actually got the benefit, he certainly could have been motivated by that benefit to come forward, regardless of whether he actually received that benefit in the end.
Well, and the flip side of that is that, you know what, although he's very unreliable, he does say that, you know, he was kind of bullied by the police, and the benefit could be just protecting himself from further harm from the police, right? I mean, like, so if he's, for example, threatened in some way, he might be like, okay, just to protect myself, I'm going to go ahead and go along with the story. So it might not be the kind of benefit we're thinking about. It could just be making sure that he doesn't get hurt in any further way.
One of the most critical times of doing time is right before your release. Everybody is on edge. The inmate who's about to leave, the guards who know that person is about to leave, because this person knows what's going on, the inside scoop on who's following the law and who isn't. And also the inmates that are left there can be very jealous. So it's a very tense time for somebody who's about to leave. Just doing this and cooperating with the authorities could have made that transition very smooth for Joey. And so the fact that he was being released shortly after, to me, doesn't mitigate it at all. It could increase the chances that he would want cooperation by the guys who make the decision as to whether he gets out or not. Because if he has a fight the day before he's supposed to get out or the morning he's supposed to get out, then he has to stay in. So it could be something that they instigate. You know, you always have to worry about that. The culture is very, very difficult there.
Also, Joey gets to rationalize it by saying, I didn't actually say that he admitted it to me. Of course, his testimony was very damning in the context of it, but he can walk away saying, I didn't say that he did it.
Yeah, and it looks like there's a number of indicators that he was literally trying to sort of be in the limelight, do what the cops wanted him to do, but not actually commit to an actual confession. And I think that that's something that should have been minimized in terms of its credibility rather than used as a major linchpin in this case against him.
I mean, isn't it safe to say that the jury probably didn't find him credible? I mean, Mark was acquitted.
It's most likely that they made some kind of determination like that. But the fact is that it is a very tenuous type of testimony, and it should never be given critical weight in a trial. And I think that in any case where jailhouse informants are the key piece of evidence tying somebody to a crime, that there should be mandatory, solid evidence that actually links them and corroborates it, rather than just the word of a number of people who are basically parroting the same story. If the details of everyone's story is exactly the same, if they have, you know, they were at different prisons and they never talked to each other and three witnesses all said exactly the same thing, then that would probably increase the credibility. But if there was any opportunity for them to sort of talk to each other or get information from the same officers, then I think that really reduces the credibility of it.
Well, also you mentioned that there could be expert testimony talking about, say, the culture of prisons and jailhouse informants in general. But just out of curiosity, when they do bring in, say, sex crime experts to these trials, are these experts specifically introduced by the state or are they introduced by the court? The idea being that they could be impartial.
Well, they're typically introduced by the state because the state has the burden of proof, but the court has to approve them. They have to be voir dired to determine whether or not that their testimony, they are qualified to give that testimony, and that that testimony would enhance the ability of the trier of fact to make a determination in the case. So it's a pretty high standard. You definitely have to have the creds and the experience in doing it before you can testify before a court of law as an expert, because you're giving your opinion about not specifics about the case. What you're doing is you're giving your opinion about the general area and how things are done and the terms of art that are going to be used, so that when the jury hears it, they understand, as opposed to being totally confused and maybe not ever really understanding what the meaning is until perhaps the closing arguments. And at that point, they could have completely dismissed the evidence in the first place.
One of the things that the episode brought up was the fact that when confronted by police with the idea of implicating a co-conspirator, Mark Free decided not to, whereas in the Adnan Syed case, Jay Wilds obviously took that opportunity. But one thing I was curious about, Rabia, was Mark Free actually charged with something at the time when they approached him about making this deal? Because my understanding was he was in on a parole violation or something like that.
I'm actually not sure. He was charged on the same day that Joey was charged, so I'm assuming that came later. But I think it was fairly clear to him that the potential existed for him to be charged when they approached him with that. But, I mean, Colin, do you know a little bit more about that?
Yeah, timing-wise, he was in jail for an unrelated probation or parole violation, and this was before either Joey or Mark would have been arrested and charged with a murder.
Well, the reason I ask was because obviously it feels like Jay Wilds was incentivized to cooperate because of the outstanding charge against him. But if there wasn't really anything hanging over Mark Free, it might have been a little easier for him to make that stand against incriminating Joey.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Jay, it's unclear whether or not his other whatever charges that we don't know too much about had a lot to do with this. But I think Jay certainly understood the power of the Baltimore City Police to charge him with something very serious, which was first-degree murder on his own. And with or without prior charges, I think that might have been enough to pressure anybody into becoming a state's witness.
I think in any situation where you have the police trying to get one co-defendant to testify against another, that there are a number of factors that sort of increase the risk of a false allegation. And the younger the defendants are, the less sophisticated they are, the poorer they are, and the less litigious they are. In other words, if they have their own lawyers standing in the background, I think that reduces the risk. But when you have people who have no real access to high-powered law firms and money, and they're young and inexperienced and not so sophisticated, the fact is that we've seen a number of very notorious cases. And I think that the Adnan case and I think the Dawkins case here both have situations in which the people that they were trying to get to rat out the other people were in a position where they could be squeezed. They weren't very sophisticated criminally. And I mean, if you've heard my analysis and Laura Richards' analysis on the Truth and Justice podcast of Jay's interviews, that you will see that there are a number of indicators that he was not truthfully disclosing, that there were a number of indicators of deception, and there were few if any, indicators of veracity throughout those recorded interviews. And so I think that it's a very dangerous thing for police to put sort of the pressure on young, inexperienced, not criminally sophisticated people, because the chances are that they will succumb to the pressure, despite the fact that they may not at all be involved or have any information, just to try to save their own necks.
How do you apply that as an investigator, though? Do you just simply not interrogate people to any depth?
No, what we did in the FBI was we have a behavioral analysis questionnaire, which a defendant can fill out, but also we can get an indirect assessment from other people that know that particular person. And you can actually, it's tied to the NEO personality inventory, and you can actually get an assessment as to the suggestibility of someone, how easily they can be pushed around and manipulated. And if they rate high in that area, you do not rely on something they say under duress. A perfect example of that is Brendan Dassey. It's clear when you see and look at all of the interrogations that were done with him, and even through his own words, the best proof of that was probably when he was on the phone with his mother, and she asked him, well, how did you come up with all that information? And he said, I just guessed, just like I do on my homework. And that's really what happens when you have a very suggestible person. So there are legitimate ways to try to weed out the people that are very suggestible and susceptible to this kind of pressure and will likely give a false confession under those circumstances. And you have to be diligent in law enforcement to avoid those things. It's your responsibility as a law enforcement officer and agent and agency to make sure you're not putting somebody in that kind of a position. You have to give it its appropriate weight and not just put all of your eggs in that one basket, especially if there's somebody very suggestible.
When I have some downtime, I love to take that time to learn about something new. That's why I'm a big fan of the Great Courses Plus. They offer fascinating video lectures across so many topics: law, history, politics, even cooking and photography. And they're presented by award-winning professors and experts. With the Great Courses Plus, you get unlimited access to all of their lectures, and new courses are added each month. You can stream these lectures anywhere, anytime. You can start them, stop them, pick them up again from any device, your smartphone, tablet, laptop, even your TV. We recommend watching their course, Privacy, Property, and Free Speech. It's a series of 24 lectures presented by Jeffrey Rosen, a professor at the George Washington University School of Law and one of the leading experts on constitutional law. In particular, I would recommend to our listeners the lecture on privacy in the police station. It covers the Miranda warnings, the problems with eyewitness identifications, and the problem of false confessions. And right now, as one of our listeners, you'll immediately get an entire month of unlimited access to all of the Great Courses Plus lectures for free when you sign up. You can start your free month today. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed. Remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed.
Colin, you mentioned in the podcast the hand of one concept, being that all the co-conspirators are guilty of the main crime that is committed. But I was just curious, how did that idea arise in the law? Because it seems like a very complicated idea to actually implement.
Yeah, I mean, it's an old common law concept where essentially it was a problem of proof, where exactly as in this situation, you have a theory that you believe multiple people joined together to commit a crime, and the thinking is, well, even if we can't prove that this specific person struck the fatal blow, that everyone involved should be responsible. And then also it's a matter of, in terms of assigning blame, you look at it and say, why should a person who was involved in a burglary and agreed to take part, and they weren't the ones who shot the homeowner, but they were involved in the scheme. It's hand of one is what I use, a joint ventureship. It's something where you undertook something together. And in essence, the theory is just like with agency. Just as an employee is an agent of an employer, if we have this plan to commit this burglary, we are in effect agents of one another, and the acts of one are attributed to the other.
But I imagine it makes prosecutions very complicated because, you know, crimes are very often chaotic events, and figuring out exactly who has agency in that situation is sometimes difficult.
I was going to say the hand of one laws are basically parallel to the conspiracy laws, and I think you have to have an agreement between two or more people, and one of those people has to commit an overt act in furtherance of that conspiracy. So there would have to have been a meeting of the minds that this was the plan. And it is not something that can happen sort of on the spur of the moment in terms of a conspiracy. It has to be something that was planned out. And then one of those people that was in that group, whether it's two people or 50 people, one of those people have to commit an act in furtherance of that. And then all 50 are guilty of that crime. So it is a way to sort of prevent people from enlisting the aid of somebody else in a crime and then having the other person do it and not actually be held accountable. That's why the conspiracy laws were made, and there are certainly a lot of applicable use. It's an important way to get people to pay for the crimes they commit or, you know, engage other people to commit for them. But it can also be used, obviously, to the extreme where you can't actually prove. And I remember the prosecutor's statements being, well, they must have met up somewhere or done something, and then this happened, as opposed to how do you know? There's no actual proof and actually no testimony that there was ever any kind of communication that preceded this that would have indicated to the other member of the conspiracy that this was the intention, that this was going to happen. And particularly with the outcome of the acquittal of Mark Free, I don't know how the other charge actually stands, because if Mark didn't pull the trigger, then who did? I mean, the whole reason for the conviction of Joey Watkins was that he had an accomplice. Otherwise, he couldn't have done it by himself. And when the accomplice side of it falls out, it really seems to me that the entire prosecution falls apart.
So, you know, what they did was they tried Joey first and they got their conviction. They tried his accomplice later, many months later, and he got acquitted, which I think just setting that up was really strategic and smart on the part of the prosecution, but also, I think, really unfair. But Colin, in a case like this, where the accomplice, without whom, apparently, according to the state, the crime can't be committed, is acquitted, is that grounds for like reopening or some kind of motion to reopen or revisiting Joey's case in court?
Unfortunately, no. Part of it is that the state never really committed at Joey's trial to Mark being the shooter. They hinted at it, but it wasn't dependent on that. But even with that, you don't necessarily need both of them to be convicted. You can have cases where you have the theory that these two people were accomplices, and it's okay. You can have inconsistent verdicts where one is convicted and one is acquitted. And that's why in this case, there weren't grounds for Joey to have his conviction thrown out.
But it leads to very complex situations. There's currently a case of a guy named Robert Montez, where he and a friend were involved in some sort of driving shooting. He took a plea deal, but his friend was acquitted. And actually, the jury came to believe it was an act of self-defense. And he is now trying to get the court to nullify his plea, because if it was, in fact, an act of self-defense, then he shouldn't be in jail just because he accepted a plea. But so far, the courts are refusing to reexamine it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same type of thinking, as I just mentioned, is that it's okay to have inconsistent verdicts in the American justice system. They don't have an issue with one jury reaching one conclusion in one case with one of the defendants. And, well, in this case, it's not a jury, but it's his plea deal. But as long as when he entered his plea, it was knowing, voluntary, intelligent, and there was an adequate factual basis for that plea, that's fine, notwithstanding the fact that a jury in another case might have found that this was self-defense.
Colin, don't you think that's a flaw in our system?
I can certainly imagine scenarios like the Joey Watkins case, where I think it's a pretty terrible rule in the sense that basically, what the prosecution had to convince the jury of was that this sharpshooter was able to pull off this shot while two vehicles were speeding down the highway. And I think that's a pretty bad application of the law. But there are other cases where, you know, you can imagine there are multiple defendants and a jury in one case might think defense counsel did a better job and the evidence was weaker, and yet we're still quite convinced that another defendant who is found guilty is in fact guilty. So I guess the difficulty I would have is I think there should be some modification to the test. I'm just not entirely sure what would be the appropriate way to cut that up with a scalpel as opposed to using a hammer.
Well, would a remedy be trying co-defendants together?
You can, but that creates its own set of issues. I mean, among other things, there's this doctrine known as the Bruton Doctrine, which makes it tough to admit a confession of one co-defendant when there's another co-defendant in the case unless the confessor is testifying. And then character evidence, which we'll get into more, is something where it could be very prejudicial to a co-defendant if you're introducing character evidence as to one. So there are many cases where we do have a joint trial of defendants, and that can make sense, but there are other cases where, for a number of reasons, both to help the prosecution and the defense, it makes sense to sever the trials and have them be separate.
Actually, there's an interesting Twitter question that I wanted to get to about this. This is from Mike M. Trainer 79, who says, "You should talk about what a sharpshooter is in the military. Episode made him sound like a sniper," which I think is actually an important distinction. Mark Free was in the National Guard, and so he became familiar with the 9mm, but that is very different than a sharpshooter, which is a very different skill set. When did the idea that he was a sharpshooter get introduced into the trial?
I believe that when Mark applied to be a police officer, he listed that he was a sharpshooter in the military, which I'm not entirely sure. Maybe Susan or Claire would know more on that. Well, there's a test that you take in the military, and sharpshooter isn't the highest. There's something above it called expert, which would be what the sniper is. And I'm not sure whether Mark, in filling out that application, was talking about the specific test and the number of targets he hit, or if he just was saying, I'm a sharpshooter because I've trained with a firearm. So I'm not 100% sure on that.
I can help answer that, because sharpshooter is not the highest, and even the expert marksman category is not necessarily sniper trained. It's just, you know, a score, basically. You have to hit a certain average when you're doing these tactical courses in the military or in the FBI or anywhere else. And the fact is that a sniper is actually a totally different set of skills, and it is trained with long gun, and they do a number of things. Like, my brother Tim was actually a sniper in the FBI, and it's a whole much higher level of training, and they do actually moving targets from a moving vehicle, from a helicopter, from a speeding truck, and so forth. Wow. That would not be the kind of training that anybody that was just down at the sharpshooter level would ever have.
Because it's a very loaded term. I would have to say, as somebody observing the trial, that, you know, would be something that held some weight for me, is to hear that he was a sharpshooter in the military.
Yeah, it just doesn't mean what people think it means. It's actually, if you only get sharpshooter, that's sort of the base. You're not going to actually pass if you don't at least make sharpshooter. It's unfortunate, but that seems like it is somebody who's extremely skilled, and it's really a basic qualification.
So I had another Twitter question. Actually, this is about Joey Watkins' legal situation in particular. It says, if the courts are such a difficult challenge at this point, what about governor commutation? What is the history in Georgia? Because we've had a lot of questions of people saying, what are his legal possibilities at this time?
Yeah, Georgia is one of the states. They have a board. It's called the State Board of Pardons and Paroles. So actually, the governor in Georgia, my understanding, doesn't have the direct authority. Instead, the case goes to this board. It's called the State Board of Pardons and Paroles, and they're the ones who would consider the application. And the history is not good. There have been a few recent cases. I think they were actually death row cases. And Bill Rankin, who does the Breakdown podcast, I know has reported on some of those. And there have been a few of the cases I've looked into where the evidence was pretty weak, and there isn't a good record in Georgia of people being granted pardons.
We also got, and this is a little off topic, but we also got a Twitter question from David Wenger, who would say, I'd still like to know how many rounds were in Heath's gun and if ballistics tests were ever done.
We'll get to that. Yeah, we're going to have an episode on ballistics and forensics, and can't say anything right now, but we'll go through all the different testing that was done and what conclusions were reached based upon that testing.
Here's another question from Thomas Ahern, who asks, did David Brown corroborate Mark Free's alibi?
That's another good question, and we'll get into the whole Mark Free trial. And actually, I think when we were recording, we had a little bit, but we cut it out from this episode. But yeah, the situation with regard to Mark's alibi is a bit complicated. So when we get to his trial, we'll delve into that in more detail.
Okay. Now, I actually wanted to bring up a little bit of a current event and get your reactions to it. My understanding is that Thiro Vignaraja has left the Office of Attorney General in Maryland. He was, of course, the lead prosecutor on Adnan's PCR hearing. Obviously, we don't know exactly why he's left the office, and there's been some speculation on social media. What are the reasons people might leave the office, you know, in such a kind of abrupt manner?
Well, you know, he's actually leaving at the end of this month. It wasn't an announcement that came from the Attorney General's office. It was information that there are networks of lawyers who hear things and passed on the information, and then a journalist was able to get it confirmed. So I don't even know if it was news that they were ready to necessarily divulge. You know, from the attorneys that I've spoken to in Baltimore, I've spoken to like 5 or 6 different people on this because I'm also curious. They all said it was highly unusual, but that it probably was a situation where he was asked for lots of different reasons, not just for Nan's case, but maybe other reasons, maybe even political reasons, but other reasons too, that he was probably asked to step down, step out.
But it is a highly unusual thing. And my understanding is there's already a successor been named, but that it's not for sure that she will be handling Anand's case?
Yeah, I mean, as far as we know, you know, the case, it's been at the Attorney General's office. Vigna Raj has been handling it. It should actually be at the city attorney's office. So we have no idea if they're going to continue to handle it with a different prosecutor. And it wasn't just, obviously, Vigna Raja alone. He had other attorneys working with him. Maybe one of them will take over at the AG's office, or maybe it'll be passed down to the city finally.
Well, I've said this on social media, and I'm truly hoping that the office will use this as a chance to reassess the situation of their evidence, because it appears that the vast majority of their evidence has completely fallen apart. And, you know, obviously for Anand's sake and for his family's sake, I think the whole case needs to be reassessed.
I'll just follow up on that, John, is that we'll see. I mean, right now, the Court of Special Appeals might very well not grant the state leave to appeal. And that would mean the order granting Adnan a new trial becomes final. And then the question becomes what happens from there. So it'll be very interesting to see. I mean, Justin will have his newest filing this week, and we'll see how it goes from there.
I mean, I do think that there is very little incentive for the state right now at this juncture to be like, okay, we're just kind of walking away from all this. They have every reason to continue to try to push it through the appellate process, keep fighting. But once, if COSA just says we're either denying this application for leave to appeal or hears it and then denies it and we're back with Judge Welch's decision, that's the point at which the state really has the opportunity to decide if they want to go forward with trial or how they want to handle it. But as long as it's in this kind of appellate thing, I don't think they will ever. I mean, they're going to see this part through at least.
So, Jim, I was curious, having heard some of the Isaac Dawkins case, do you have any questions that you wanted to pose to Colin Rabia?
I would really be interested in having, like, what I would love to do is get a really deep dive into the victimology. I mean, if you really want to solve this murder, that's where we have to start. And obviously, there is some information that I was able to glean in the last couple of days, but I have not seen the details of what was really going on in his life. And it seems to me that the police sort of took an easy way out, tried to find somebody that they could get to rat on somebody else instead of actually doing a comprehensive investigation. I mean, they must have been frustrated having not been able to solve this right away. And we all know that in the first 2 or 3 days, if you don't solve a homicide, the chances of solving it go down dramatically. So it must have been very frustrating for them. And, you know, this is the outcome. But I still hope that if they did not do it, that I hope that there's some legal remedy for Joey Watkins, you know, if he's actually innocent. And given the, you know, I just hate the fact that prosecutors can still have sort of inconsistent theories in cases. And I think we saw that in the Avery Dassey case. And I think, you know, that's falling apart, obviously, at least against Dassey, it's fallen apart. And I think that once that happens, I do believe that in the interest of justice, not in the interest of time or efficiency, but in the interest of justice, they should reopen an investigation, especially if the theory of that investigation and the conviction is based on information that now is found to be unreliable.
Jim, I have a question for you as a former prosecutor. I mean, I'm actually kind of, given the nature of this particular crime that, you know, resulted in Isaac's death, how difficult it would be for even somebody with really high proficiency in gun skills to shoot from one moving vehicle into another and at night and then make a fatal shot. I'm kind of surprised that prosecutors and police didn't look at this as kind of a crime of like a random shooting that happened to hit a target versus a deliberate, premeditated type of crime. I mean, would you as a prosecutor assess it like that? I mean, and even knowing just, I mean, you knowing all these things about ballistics and sharpshooting and all these things, I mean, doesn't it seem much more likely that it was maybe just somebody just shooting for the sake of whatever? Maybe there's some road rage or something involved and they just happen to hit somebody.
It's possible. I think that, you know, as I said earlier, if you're going to try to intentionally kill somebody while they're driving, you know, at a high rate of speed, it's not the easiest thing to pull off. So it is possible that that could happen, but it's also not probable. And I would certainly have to look at the ballistics and look at the angles of entry and how, you know, across that motion, whether, I mean, you should be able to tell, I would think, whether or not the shooter was stationary or actually in a moving vehicle going the same speed. I mean, if there are multiple shots, then you're going to see changes in angles of entry if they are stationary versus in a moving vehicle. Also, I don't know what they did in terms of, you know, going out and doing metal detector searches and so forth and finding where bullets that went through the vehicle ended up, because that can also tell you something about what was going on and exactly when the shots were fired. So I'd be really interested, Colin, when you guys do cover that, to hear about all the ballistics. It's an important part of this case, and I think it could rule in or rule out specific theories. And you know what? Those facts are what the prosecution should be based on, not just speculation.
But you were saying that the probability was low of it being a random shooting. Would your assessment of that probability change knowing that there were recent shootings on highways very close by?
Oh, no, I meant the exact opposite. I said the probability of doing a high-speed chase one vehicle to another and committing an intentional killing
is low. Got it. So it actually argues for the random shooting theory.
Right. And that either being a drive-by type shooting or somebody from a stationary point who is trying to pick off a car going by. You know, those are two different types of events that could result in this conclusion.
I actually have a quick question. I'm actually going to be traveling overseas when the show premiere comes on next week, and I'm really upset about that. Can it be seen online, do you know? Like, would it be on CBS.com?
It will be, and we're actually currently in negotiations of selling it to other cable providers, maybe an Amazon or a Netflix, and we may have an enhanced six-hour version of the show on those venues. So there actually may be. Obviously, we had hundreds of hours of footage to boil down to a four-hour show, so we will be doing a Real Crime Profile series of podcasts where we get behind the scenes, and also we'll be doing a more extensive release of the investigation down the road.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much for coming, Jim.
All right. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate everything you're doing.
So I just wanted to say thank you, Rabia. Thank you, Colin. Also, thank you, Rabia, for writing Adnan's story. I am about 7 chapters into the audiobook, which I highly recommend if anybody wants to check it out. Even for somebody who knows most of this stuff already, it is just absolutely riveting. So thank you once again for writing it, and thanks for being here again. In our last addendum, Darby Dickerson spoke about the jaw-dropping statistics of how little time public defenders actually get to spend with their clients. I think it was on the order of 12 minutes if it's a misdemeanor, and maybe an hour for a felony in many jurisdictions. So, given the current crisis state of the public defender system, I wanted to let you know that I will be donating my fee this week to an organization called Gideon's Promise. They are based in Atlanta, Georgia, and they're leading a new civil rights movement to help prevent millions of people from being deprived of justice because they are poor. Gideon's Promise is building an army of advocates to fight for the many innocent or overcharged citizens processed into prison cells with an advocate too overwhelmed to provide the representation they deserve. And many of the nation's law schools are joining the fight as part of the organization's Law School Partnership Program. The program recruits talented third-year law students who are interested in public service and places them in positions at underserved public defender offices. Students who participate in the LSPP receive a commitment of a permanent job within 1 year from the public defender's offices where they are placed. To date, many of the nation's top law schools have joined this initiative. So you can reach them on the web at gideonspromise.org. They were brought to my attention by Shauna Geiger, so thank you, Shauna. And fans can discuss the show on Twitter at #undisclosed or #justiceforjoey. If you want to tag questions for future addenda, you can use #UDAddendum, or you can tweet them directly at me at Mr. John Cryer. Also, if you've got any worthy organizations for the wrongfully convicted, I gotta say I'm so grateful for all the submissions that you guys have been sending me. I'd say 9 out of 10 so far have been from my Twitter followers, so thank you. As always, I want to remind you to check out the website, undisclosed-podcast.com. That's where we've got all the case documents that are there for your perusal. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project, at @GAInnocence. Gonna thank Hannah McCarthy once again for her expert audio production, as well as Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media, and you should check out her Crime Writers On podcast. I'm going to give a shout out to Patrick Cortez for composing the addenda theme in all its melancholy wonder. And one last thank you to Meethal Telhan, who is our project manager and always the one who's submitting me all the great articles that I get to read every week. Thank you, Meethal, and thank you guys for listening. And we've got a lot more coming your way.